Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When people are happy with risk and embrace risk, then by definition, prices go high. When the cycle turns down, they generally sell at prices that are far too low.
This is not about getting more information. We live in a world where we have too much data.
I'm happy to report another stable quarter.
Hello and welcome to Aktiesnack. This is a podcast made in partnership with Kalkyl. And as you might be noticing, we're speaking English today, and that's because we have the American investor Adam Wyden with us. He is the founder of the hedge fund ADW Capital. And he is also the largest shareholder of Nordic e-commerce company Cedion, where he holds a stake of 28%. But first, a big thanks to our main sponsor, Pinpoint Estimates.
On pinpointestimates.com, Swedish investors can see estimates from other investors before a company's report.
By sharing your estimate on Pinpoint, you can compare your expectations with other investors and the Pinpoint consensus. The consensus of investor estimates. And the consensus is a good benchmark, especially for companies with no or low analyst coverage.
You can start today by estimating on your favorite stocks. And next up is the report period for the fourth quarter. So what do we say now, Magnus?
We say a big thanks to our main sponsor, Pinpoint Estimates.
Welcome to the podcast, Adam.
Thank you for having me, guys, and really excited to chat with you guys. Fire away whenever you're ready.
Of course. This is actually our first conducted interview in English, so I would say that's a huge privilege for you, or maybe a privilege for us. I don't know how to define it. But we can start off by talking about you, Adam. So tell us, who is Adam Wyden, both as a person and as an investor?
It's a great question. I think hopefully each sort of person is more or less the same. You know, I am a lifelong investor and problem solver. You know, I've been investing from a very, very young age. My great uncle was a day one investor in Price Club, which, you know, ultimately became Costco. And then, you know, then subsequently invested in Qualcomm. You know, his, and he invested and backed it many companies throughout the lifetime. And, you know, his mantra was invest with people that are very hardworking and smart and have more to lose than you do. And, you know, we've been trying to, you know, sort of apply that principle, you know, and I've been trying to apply that principle, you know, both through my investing life and even my personal life. So, you know, I've been investing my whole life, had many businesses growing up. I had a car detailing business. You know, I had an early foray into marketplaces where I was building my own remote control cars and buying them at hobby stores and reassembling them and selling them on eBay at a markup, multiple markups. I had a car detailing business, as I said, in high school, you know, where we, you know, basically, you know, a few employees and, you know, we detailed luxury cars. And as a human being, I'm a businessman and a problem solver, you know, as relates to sort of my background. You know, I went to Wharton, I worked at a hedge fund in college, worked at sort of a merchant bank out of college. You know, I think in graduate school, really narrowed my focus to sort of these smaller capitalization special situations similar to Cedion, where we're trying to find companies that are sort of in transition or transformation that are, you know, sort of not appreciated by the public markets and for whatever reason are sort of massively mispriced. And so, you know, I did that, and, you know, that sort of journey sort of started about in 2006, you know, after college. You know, it's about 16 plus years ago, you know, sort of continued to invest on my own account, went to Columbia Business School, you know, the home of value investing, and took a number of classes there. And, you know, I think that that was sort of concurrent with the great financial crisis. And, you know, we found a number of small companies that, you know, sort of fit that mold. You know, you call it, you know, this sort of sum of the parts, special situation, orphan, you know, call it orphan security investing. You know, one of which was this company, IDT Corporation, that I'm sure many of your, you know, audience have followed. It's, you know, sort of a classic owner operator business. And, you know, they, it was a holding company with a number of assets. And we, I put, you know, about half of my net worth in the company at $2 personally. And, you know, it made 15 times my money in 15 months. And so, you know, sort of had to, you know, search my soul a little bit, you know, after graduating Columbia Business School, and really tried to want to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. And, you know, I, you know, was it going to Goldman Sachs or working at a big hedge fund, like a, you know, like an equivalent of a CVN, and doing sort of that, you know, sort of hamster wheel, so to speak? Or did I really want to sort of blaze my own trail, so to speak, and start my own business? So in 2011, ADW Capital was birthed. And, you know, we've been doing that now for, I'm in year 12. I think we're, you know, very excited about sort of the opportunities that the market dislocation has, you know, presented in front of us for our strategy. And, you know, excited to talk about CDON and everything else.
Interesting, Adam. You mentioned special situations there. So I guess one of your role models might be Greenblatt, right?
Yes.
Yeah, yes. So please tell us a bit more about your role models and also your investment philosophy. Like, is it value-focused growth or GARP, or maybe, of course, Greenblatt, but is there anyone else?
Obviously, you know, Joel Greenblatt was and has been an enormous influence on me. You know, we read the books, you know, when I graduated college and school. And, you know, obviously my great uncle was a big fan of Peter Lynch and, you know, told me to read One Up on Wall Street and, you know, some of these, you know, books, you know, that sort of give you that McKinsey top-down analysis, invest in what you know, go and talk to people, do surveys, you know, sort of, you know, very important of like understand the products, you know, sort of do a qualitative analysis. So, you know, Peter Lynch.
So, what books besides One Up on Wall Street?
Beating the Street is another book that Peter Lynch wrote. But, yeah, you know, the Peter Lynch books, the Joel Greenblatt books, you know, obviously Warren Buffett, you know, most people don't realize, but, you know, his early career was, you know, sort of doing nets and event driven, you know, even some activism. And then he sort of, you know, gravitated to sort of compounders at good prices. And, you know, that's the hope, right? That we sort of buy things in dislocation, whether it's, you know, Ferrari being spun off from Fiat and buying it at 5x EBITDA and letting it compound. So, you know, you ask me value, growth, GARP. I mean, hopefully all of it. We want to buy these things at sort of value prices and then, you know, get the growth for free. And I would say that's sort of, you know, our analogy, you know, sort of like the, where we want to live.
Great answer.
And what opened your eyes for CDON? How come you found this little company up in Sweden?
You know, I've always sort of wanted to have some exposure to the Nordics. You know, we followed it and we followed CVN, and there's been a lot of really good equity, you know, equity returns in Sweden. Obviously, now they don't have oil, which is challenging, but in general, many of the Nordic countries have been heavily reliant on oil. And, you know, we've just always been super impressed with the corporate governance in Sweden, you know, sort of the general economic trends, you know, the education, the governance, the technology, the internet penetration. So first off, we were very interested in sort of, you know, having some exposure to Sweden over the years. I think that that was something that we've always heard so many great things about it. And, you know, obviously when we were presented with an opportunity to invest in Sweden, that was obviously super interesting for us. And then as it relates to CDON specifically, we had done a bunch of work on C Limited and, you know, obviously Mercado Libre and, you know, Etsy to a lesser degree. You know, we've always been impressed with sort of the marketplace model. And many American investors have had a great deal of success sort of investing in this sort of the foreign equivalent of an American business. I mean, you know, Tiger Global, you know, obviously they're having a tough time this year, but, you know, they made a fortune buying JD.com and taking 360buy and Dongdong and merging them to become JD. I mean, that's a $50 billion company that they invested in a $200 million market cap. And, you know, part of that analysis was, could they create an Amazon, you know, in China? And, you know, look, whether it's the Somwer brothers at Rocket Internet or Tiger Global, many investors have effectively taken, you know, really great business models that have applied in the United States and sort of taken those, you know, to the, you know, the foreign market and sort of capitalized them. And what we like about that is, you know, investors in that local market, because they've never experienced it or invested behind it, they don't really know how to evaluate it. But that's sort of the opportunity on the valuation side. Now, on the execution side, you've got to actually, you know, succeed on building it out and growing it. But, you know, that's, you know, something that you have to be patient around. So that was sort of the initial first principles around what attracted us to CDON. We knew that marketplace works, right? We knew it. It works everywhere. Why is Sweden any different? It shouldn't be. It's a beautiful place. The Nordics are a beautiful place. People are well educated. There's technology. There's internet penetration. The other thing we really thought was interesting is that, you know, the population density, the people, the MSAs were very, very closely knit. You have, you know, whether it's Copenhagen or Oslo or Gothenburg or Malmo or Stockholm, if you think about sort of the penetration, sort of what the MSAs and where the populations are, they were all very closely knit. So like as it relates to, you know, delivery, supply chain, logistics, you know, we thought the ability to sort of facilitate e-commerce and logistics and marketplace, it sort of was, had many positive, you know, sort of attributes that way. And in fact, Canada was very similar to that, right? Where Canada has a similar population actually to all of the Nordics, but all of Canada, it's a huge country, right? But all of this, the people are sort of in these sort of clustered areas, and we've seen Amazon work very well there. So, you know, again, I think those were sort of the things that initially attracted us to CDON.
Interesting. And I also think it's interesting that you were selling on eBay early on, like when you were a teenager, and that you liked and related to the marketplace model, and now you're investing heavily in the marketplace model. And also, you mentioned Mercado Libre, and I actually own shares there, and it's kind of the same investment case as you put up now for CDON. So I think that that's a little interesting side note. So when you invest in a foreign country like Sweden, how much do you value input from locals, for
well,
example,
I mean, look,
what they think of CDON?
Obviously, their input is extremely important, and you know, I would say that you know you have to sort of balance the sort of the customer experience with sort of the financial experience. And so we spent actually a lot of time in Sweden last year. And I think what was interesting is that the locals, I'm not sure all of the locals sort of understand the difference between marketplace, you know, sort of a 1P or 3P model. I think they understand customer experience. They understand, you know, this is where I go to get X, Y, and Z. But I'm not sure that like the actual local consumer understands whether they control the inventory or not, which from a stock perspective is great, because then, you know, when the model works, you sort of get the benefits of the flywheel and the unit economics, you know. So the short answer is, you know, I obviously respect, you know, immensely. These are the customers. They're the lifeblood of your business. They need to have a good experience. They need to be able to get the products. I think, you know, from an input perspective of like, if someone says to me, oh, well, CDON only has X, you know, I could say, well, yes, if you're talking about a BHG or a Boost, like it's unlikely that a BHG or a Boost is going to be able to expand product categories as seamlessly as maybe a CDON is, because if I go to CDON, I've got to convince the merchant to let me sell their products. If I'm doing, if it's BHG or Boost or Rug Vista or Claes Olsen or whatever, those companies, they have to take the inventory, and taking inventory is gambling, right? If I don't sell that inventory, I've got to go and give it away at a low gross margin. And, you know, you're seeing that to some degree with companies, you know, across the board here, right? If you came into 2022 with a lot of inventory, right, you're selling it, you're taking losses, right? You bought that inventory for, you know, $100 million. If you, you know, if you sell it, you know, at a negative gross margin, you know, you're losing that money. That money is gone. And I think what initially attracted us to sort of marketplace is that the financial flexibility that it avails, you know, sort of the guy who's running it is just enormous, right? It's like if you can just figure out a way to get a lot of products without having to take on inventory, then, you know, in theory, you know, you are, you know, giving customers, you know, access to lots of products, right? You're allowing them to, you know, sort of leverage their loyalty, right? If you have a like a Amazon Prime or a CDON Plus, if I can get you a subscription, get you free delivery, right? And you can get all of your stuff from one place, you know, with loyalty, with, you know, free shipping and these or that, like that's an enormous value to the customer, right? Like if I tell you, oh, I got to get a subscription for Boost and a subscription for BHG and I got to get a subscription for Clas Ohlson and, you know, same with the food delivery, you know, like in the United States, it's like if I'm Uber Eats or DoorDash or whatever, I've got to get a subscription for each one of them to get the free delivery. If I can get the same food people from all one place, right? Because those food places, they're effectively marketplaces too, right? Like, you know, in Europe, it's, yeah, I guess they have Delivery Hero and Just Eat, and I don't know what they have in Sweden, but I should know. But like, my point is that like, you know, if you can sort of centralize all of the merchants in one place, you know, you're adding value to that customer because they're building loyalty, they're getting points, they're getting free shipping. And so, you know, again, you know, obviously customer experience is very, very important. Like they need to like have a good experience and it needs to be, you know, seamless and good. But like, I think it is not negotiable in my mind. Like it's like, I refuse to believe that one-stop shopping isn't a value to the end customer. Like I refuse to believe that someone in Sweden wants to download 12 apps on their phone and like go and pick products from each phone because you're going to have to buy a delivery subscription for each thing. And yes, I get it. The 1P is very well run in Sweden. I understand that. But the thing I'm trying to say here is that like categorically, a well-run marketplace is superior to 1P. And you see that in Amazon. You see that across the world. It's not like running 1P, you know, and running it to the extent that you want to make the customer experience that good, it's a loss-making business because at the end of the day, you're gambling. You're buying inventory and you're making a bet on what people want to buy. And, you know, it's retail. It's strictly retail. It's not a marketplace. It's buying and selling goods and making bets on them. And I just think that's a business where you have to get it right every single time. And not even Amazon can get it right with their 1P business. So I think, you know, to me, the major challenge we have is, you know, getting customers, continuing to increase the value proposition, getting more SKUs, getting more merchants, and letting customers in Sweden and the Nordics know that like this model exists and it's to their benefit.
And how do you view the competition from Amazon?
To be honest, I think, you know, for better or for worse, I don't think the Nordics is a particularly good market for Amazon. It's not, I don't think it's big enough, right? We estimate the market at about 500 billion SEK, growing to about a trillion, you know, over the next, you know, call it 4 to 5 years. So, you know, again, on a US dollar basis, you know, not to sound sort of arrogant or glib or whatever you want to call it, like, you know, 50 billion to 100 billion market is not really that relevant to Amazon. I think that's reflected in sort of the product that they're delivering. You know, they're just translating the German site. But even aside from that, as it relates to CDON, right, like in most markets, usually the top two players, you know, are, you know, usually 60-70%. So, you know, if Amazon takes 50% and CDON takes 5%, I'd be pretty happy. I mean, if in 5 years, you know, the market is a trillion SEK and they have 5% of it, that's a 50 billion GMV company. If it trades at, you know, 2 or 3 times GMV, that's, you know, 100 to 150 billion GMV. Sorry, 100 to 150 billion market cap. And I think the market cap of CDON right now is 1.4 billion SEK. So, you know, again, I think the bar is pretty low as it relates to what the asymmetry of the business is. You know, obviously there are a bunch of other smaller marketplaces that are floating around. There's Findic, there's another one I was reading around, Land something. Like there are a few marketplaces, but I mean, obviously, as you know, marketplace in Sweden has not really gotten a liftoff. And, you know, that to me is sort of, you know, really interesting. Now, obviously it's going to take...
So what do you think is the reason for that, Adam?
Why do I think that is? I think it's because there really hasn't been one... I mean, it's sort of like a chicken or the egg thing. It's like there hasn't been one-stop shopping in Sweden ever. I mean, even CDON in the early 2000s, what have you, it was books and CDs and toys. I mean, it's always been, you know, sort of very bifurcated or siloed. And I don't think anyone has really tried to do it. Now, CDON, right, is the closest thing, right? They took their 1P business, they migrated it to 3P, primarily books, toys, electronics, and stuff like that. And they've expanded categories, right? And so, you know, just because it hasn't happened doesn't mean it shouldn't happen. I just think in general, you know, you need to, you know, sort of put capital and energy and know-how behind that. And I think, you know, by and large, You know, CDON is really the only company that's attempting to do it. Yes, Amazon is trying to do it, but you know that I don't think in all honesty they've sort of given it, you know, sort of the right energy and efforts, and maybe they will in the future. But just because it hasn't happened, you know, I don't think that means it won't happen. Is my point. Like I think that, and I also think that like delivery and logistics and some of these things that sort of, you know, lend themselves, you know, same day shipping and this and that. Like I'm sure, like, to our understanding, that's sort of a little bit behind the US, but it's improving dramatically. So just because it hasn't happened doesn't mean it won't. You know, obviously CDON has been able to grow to, you know, 2 billion GMV, which is obviously the largest marketplace in the Nordics. It's obviously their penetration of total e-commerce is sort of a non-event. But I do think that, you know, sort of the flywheel and sort of the incremental math that comes from, you know, getting big merchants and getting more products, I think is just very, very powerful from this size. So, you know, I think, you know, our focus now is just making sure that, you know, we prioritize resources, you know, and sort of do things sort of in the right sequencing.
Interesting. So CDON recently changed its CEO. So why did they do this? And do you believe this was a good move?
I do. I really, really do. This, you know, whenever you're doing a transformation, you know, in this case, you know, we've invested in many. We've invested in PAR Technology. You know, we've got, you know, you guys want to talk about Rick. You know, I've invested in a lot of what I would call hairy or sort of not, you know, not obvious, clean sum of the parts stories. So this is sort of business as usual for us. You know, we understand that when you convert, you know, a business from 1P to 3P, there's going to be some growing pains. So, you know, just to give you the history, you know, and again, I'm sure most of you guys know it, CDON was this, you know, online deal, and, you know, then it was controlled by Kinnevik, and they had a bunch of different stuff in it, and then, you know, it was in Clearo, and then, you know, Right Ventures bought the stake from Kinnevik, and then they distributed all the assets, you know, Nelly, Clearo, CDON, and I think the idea was is that, you know, when CDON was sort of independent with its own balance sheet and its own cost of capital, you know, that they could effectively, you know, get the business to the next level and sort of make investments without, you know, other sort of, you know, people involved and sort of other decision makers. So, you know, that's sort of how CDON worked. You know, Christopher Vallaharju did a very nice job taking this business, you know, I don't know, from 2017 to 2020. He had a very bad heart condition and unfortunately, you know, wasn't, you know, sort of up to the challenge, you know, to sort of run this thing in the public markets and whatnot. And that's totally germane. And, you know, obviously the company had some challenges last year. You know, they had a platform change that sort of coincided with his health, which was unfortunate. But I think, you know, the company sort of got beyond that, got that behind them. And, you know, and sort of finish the year okay. I think the idea is that, you know, when they hired, you know, Kjellberg, you know, who is, you know, sort of like, you know, more of a divisional leader, right? He was a CMO, he was a product guy. He's a big company guy who says, give me a budget and, or sorry, give me, you know, ask me what to do and I'll give you a budget and, you know, I'll do it. And I think that, you know, in a business like this, where yes, it has, you know, many, many great secular growth opportunities, you know, you have to be able to prioritize resources. And I think in a year like this, where Nordic e-commerce is down 15% and we're spending lots of money on sort of long dated, you know, call option type things like a pre-owned business. And no, I think the new website and buy box, all that will be out there in January. That's great. But I think, you know, sort of bringing on a marketing and branding person, you know, to make sort of long dated investments in the context of sort of a, you know, sort of a down economy, I just don't think he was the right CEO, you know, for this period. And he said as much. And so we're super excited for the company to sort of get the cost structure back to where it was. I mean, there's 60 to 65 million that they said is basically a return to back to where the cost structure was in 2020. So I don't think that this is like some Herculean thing. In fact, if you go back and look, the segment financial, CDON was profitable 2018, 19, and 20. So, you know, they've run this business profitably. You know, Christopher Vallaharju ran it profitably inside of Clearo. So no reason to believe that they can't get back to that. I think that, you know, if you are looking at it glass half full, you might even say that an aggressive entrepreneur, you know, uses this as an opportunity to sort of drive higher take rates and higher margins from, you know, merchants who, you know, would otherwise have to take massive write downs on their products. I mean, remember, what people don't realize is CDON is a broker, right? And if you follow, you know, a Panalpina or a C.H. Robinson or an Expeditors or any of these companies, well-run middlemen, right? Because that's what we are. We're a middleman, right? A well-run middleman, you know, makes higher margins when times are really good and when times are really bad. And so in an environment like this, when a retailer can't sell their products, you know, necessarily, that's a good environment, right? That's an opportunity for a well-run e-commerce merchant, you know, marketplace to say, hey, you know what, like I need a higher take rate, you know, because we're doing less volume. And the guy who's on the other side of it looks at it and says, well, okay, like I've got all this merchandise sitting on my shelves. If I don't sell it, I'm going to have to, you know, send it to the outlet or, you know, light it on fire or what have you. And so in my mind, it's sort of like, you know, a really, you know, sort of well-oiled commercial machine can actually take advantage and grow margins, grow take rate and, you know, enhance sales and marketing. But you need someone with that, you know, sort of muscle memory. It's not really the right environment for sort of a corporate person. And so while we appreciate Peter's efforts, we think he's done a lot of great things for the company in terms of, you know, merchant acquisition and whatnot. I think the ability to sort of be nimble and agile is sort of favors a sort of a more leaner and entrepreneurial ecosystem. And I think that's where we're getting to. And, you know, look, we're the largest shareholder. You know, we have board representation. You know, Right Ventures, you know, owns 25% of the company or what have you. And, you know, everybody is, you know, immensely, you know, aligned as it relates to, you know, sort of trying to maximize shareholder value. You know, there is no one in the, you know, no one, you know, sort of sitting around the table doesn't have a hugely vested economic interest. And so, you know, I think that's, you know, that's sort of how we're looking at it. You know, we don't know what the economy will be next year. You know, the comps were very bad last year, you know, 22 for the economy. You know, they might be bad next year, they might be flat, but I can tell you that, you know, we don't see anything in sort of this restructuring that would preclude the company from participating. In fact, the company won market share every quarter this year. And if you look at the most recent release tied to the restructuring, the company said that they continue to win market share year to date. So, you know, again, if the market is up 5 next year and we're up 10, and we're on a much leaner cost structure, I mean, the incremental margins are incredible. And I think that's the part that I think people really miss in all of this, which says that if you're $2 billion of GMV and you grow and the market grows 10 and you grow 20, well, that's $400 million of GMV. If your take rates go to 13% or 15% where they should go with advertising and, you know, better optimization, your marketing's 3. I mean, that's, you know, $40 million of EBIT, right? You know, that's pretty powerful, and you don't take any inventory risk. So, you know, in our minds, it's sort of like the incremental margins are very powerful. And if you look at Allegro, for example, Allegro in Poland had 60% margins before they sort of bought 1P. So, you know, we think that these things can have, you know, 50, 60, 70% margins. I mean, I know a lot of people look at Hemnet and stuff like that, and they're like, oh, well, that's not the same. But I mean, Hemnet's a marketplace. They have 95% gross margins. They have 70% EBITDA margins. That's what we have. We get 95% gross margins on net sales. And at scale, we would have, you know, 50, 60, 70% margins. So, you know, the key is making sure that we protect that equity value, that we protect, you know, long-term investors from any dilution. So that's sort of how we're looking at it, right? We want to protect, you know, sort of the terminal value of the opportunity. And that's why we're restructuring the business. And, you know, we'll continue to make investments in growth initiatives when the market comes back.
Do you have any clue how long CDON has come with their advertising business, like percentage of GMV, for instance?
It's too small. It's a huge opportunity for the company. Yeah, it's way too small.
Yeah, no.
I mean, most advertising is 3% of GMV, 3, 4, 5%, and we're very, very small. So, and that to me is a very easy thing to fix, right? That's, you know, sweat equity. And so, you know, I think that that's one of the low hanging fruit things that we could do pretty easily.
I agree.
That we need to focus on.
So if I were to summarize the big changes taking place at CDON right now, that would be the new tech platform, changes in the management, and also shifting focus from 1P to 3P, right?
Well, we're already at 90% 3P. 1P is only, like, that's what people don't realize. 1P is probably less than 10% of all total GMV. So you can see that in the gross margins, right? The gross margins last quarter were 53%, right? So that 10% is like a gross margin of 10, whereas the other 90 is like a gross margin of 95. So that's why it averages to 55. But that's sort of the point. Like, you're going to see this thing in a couple of years with like an 80% gross margin. But no one is doing the math. So that's what's exciting for us, right? Like, we see 1P getting smaller and 3P getting bigger. And when people pull it up in their Capital IQ or FactSet or Bloomberg, and they see a business that has, you know, whatever, you know, net sale, you know, it'll be almost entirely, 3P, you know, you'll see a business with a sort of a 95% gross margin. And, that's a business that should be valued more like a software company than a retailer, right? Because 95% gross margin is valued as a multiple of gross profit, not as a multiple of EBITDA. And, you know, that's sort of why we are sort of so surprised, you know, with CDON's trading valuations, because it's like, we look at this business and we're like, okay, it's trading at like 4 or 5 times gross profits, right? And in our minds, it's sort of like, you know, break even software businesses in the United States, those things trade at 5 or 6 times revenue, where in, you know, and that's, you know, that's in the, you know, post downturn. And, you know, as a multiple of gross profit, those things are like 7 or 8 times, you know, at least, if not more. And, you know, whether your gross margin is 70 or 80. So like, in my mind, it's sort of like, you know, even in a sort of a zero growth environment, you know, we think CDON is worth, you know, more than double where it's trading at right now. And, you know, then when you think about what it's, and then you kind of take a step further and say, hey, Hemnet trades, I get it, Hemnet makes money, and we can talk about that. But at this scale, the company making money or not is to me is sort of less relevant, right? If CDON was not making money at a 20 billion GMV, then I would agree with you. But obviously, you know, you're more interested in understanding what the margins are at scale as opposed to, you know, margins at this scale, right? And, you know, at this scale, like, I'm really more focused on the gross margin, and the gross margin is there. So, you know, from our perspective, we sort of look at it and say to ourselves, okay, you got a 25 million US, you know, it's effectively 25 million US dollar gross profit business. If that can be run profitably, break even, you know, EBITDA, what would this sort of be worth to sort of a strategic acquirer? What would it sort of be worth, you know, to somebody else? And, you know, I think the short answer is more. I don't know if it's worth double or triple to a strategic acquirer. But then the question is, okay, let's say it stays public and it keeps going. Well, if they actually succeed at getting to 56, you know, getting to, you know, scale and profit and this and that, then this thing would trade at something like 30 times EBIT, you know, which is like a, you know, 3% free cash flow yield. And, you know, 30 times EBIT is something like, whatever, I don't know, 25, 26 times gross profit. So right now we're trading at 4 or 5 times gross profit. If this thing is successful, you can expect the multiple to go up 5 or 6 times, not including the growth. So to us, I mean, that's just sort of like, you know, we're sort of sitting here scratching our head being like, well, you know, even just the optionality of being sold to a strategic is worth double or triple. And then if it works, right, you're talking, and they grow revenues, you know, they grow GMV, you know, even if the market grows 10% or 7% per annum, and this thing grows 15% per annum sales, it's going to get to 50-60% margins pretty easily, and should trade at like 20 times gross profit, you know, to sort of, because the gross profit is so high from a margin perspective, that when you think about sort of where it is on EBIT, it's a very, very high multiple. So, you know, that to us is sort of like, yes, we understand, like, you know, the company has not executed perfectly, but, you know, in our mind, it's sort of like, you know, in a base case, you know, if this thing sort of grows 10 or 15%, the market grows 5%, they're going to get to big margins, multiple is going to expand dramatically. And, you know, even if you think that this company sort of muddles along and grows 2% and, you know, underperforms the market, but they do it profitably, you know, we still think that the business is worth multiples more to a strategic, just on the fact that, like, we believe that marketplace makes sense, and sort of whether it's getting done inside of a 1P, you know, and like, I wouldn't put it past the fact that like a BHG or like a Claus Olsen, you know, I know that one of the companies tried to do their own marketplace, but they didn't really have the tech and the capabilities. But I mean, you know, if you could put it inside of a 1P player and, you know, leverage your sales and marketing expense, I'm not so sure that someone else couldn't, you know, take this inside. Now, I'm not, you know, saying that it couldn't be done on its own here, but I'm just saying, like, the strategic value here is immense. Having 2 billion of GMV, you know, in marketplaces is valuable. And I think, you know, all of the stuff that goes into it, the corporate G&A, the marketing, all of that stuff could be optimized inside of someone else's company if this was a subscale public company.
So if you would guess, do you like see any or know any potential strategic buyers of CDON?
Well, I mean, look, I think all of the global players it's relevant for, right? If you're Allegro, if you're Meli, if you're Bol.com, if you're JD, if you're Alibaba, if you're C, I mean, I look, again, you know, I don't know if anyone's buying anything at this exact moment. Maybe they are, but yes, I think all of the global marketplace players are valuable. And then I would just take a step back and say, any private equity firm, any, you know, that's more of a financial arrangement, but any private equity firm, any 1P player, any sort of like a Schibsted, or even could Kinnevik buy the whole thing? Could Prosus, Naspers? I mean, I know they bought this company called Avito, which is a classifieds business. I mean, the short answer is, anyone that sort of is touching marketplace or classifieds, globally, I think is relevant, just because the optionality of this opportunity in and of itself is worth more than $150. I mean, this thing is now trading, effectively at, 205 times 6.4 minus 100 cash. It's 1.2 divided by 10 point. I mean, this thing's trading like, 120 million US dollars. Like, that's not a lot of money.
I actually think that what you touched upon before, what a rational buyer would pay for the business, I think that's actually Warren Buffett's definition of intrinsic value. What a rational buyer would pay for the entire business. But right. you touched upon valuation here. So how do you usually conduct your valuation? It's like DCF, multiple based, or relative valuation. So talk about how you usually value companies, because now you talked about, gross profit multiples and sales multiples and stuff like that. So give us something about how you usually value businesses and also how you value CDON.
In the case of CDON, I think, we today sort of look at it on an EV to gross profit basis. And basically, from our perspective, obviously, if the company is committing to being break even on EBITDA today, it's not rat, and it doesn't really make sense for it to be valued on an EV to EBITDA basis. So, we sort of value it on EV to gross profit, because we don't think, the sales multiple is necessarily relevant. We look at it in, gross profit really tells you what the incremental margins can be from here. And sort of like, if you're thinking about like sort of a software business, a lot of them do, EV to sales, but we think, given that these things have 95 to 96% gross margins, we actually think EV gross profit is probably more relevant than EV to sales. Obviously, as a going concern company, that we would build a DCF, and we would say, okay, GMV is 2 billion. We think that the market in Sweden is going to grow 10%, say. And let's say it's a complete train wreck, and we only grow 15% GMV. We win a little bit of market share, but we just grow with the market. We would run out the 15% GMV growth. We would figure out what that is in terms of net sales growth and gross profit growth. We would figure out what the incremental EBITDA margins are, and we would take it out to some year, whether it's year 5 or year 7, and we would put some sort of terminal value multiple of EBIT, whether it's 25 or 30 times, and then discount it back. So that would be DCF, right? And I think that's how people value software companies, and that's how people sort of value high gross margin businesses. I don't like doing DCF on businesses that don't have high incremental margins, because things can change, but for software and sort of software related businesses that have high gross margins, we like to use DCF, because that, sort of helps you think about what cash flow is in the long term. And, obviously, your ability to flex costs in the software technology business is sort of different than, maybe like a trucking company, right? Like, there's a lot more fixed costs. Like, if CDON had woken up and said, we wanted to cut 85 million or 100 million, they probably could have done that too. I mean, I don't, So my point is that like, this is an extremely variable cost model. And so whether it makes EBITDA today, whether it makes zero next year or makes 20, like that's sort of less relevant to us, because, the costs are very much variable, right? It's a 95% gross margin. So the only real cost that you need to do is sort of the sales and marketing. The fixed G&A base can be flexed enormously.
And if you would summarize the investment case in 30 seconds, how would it be?
I think the summary is, this company is a very, very well-known brand. It has brand affinity. Yes, is it the butt of some people's jokes? Sure. We've gotten some surveys from folks, and a lot of people actually like it, and even the younger people. So we do think that there's some brand loyalty there. They've successfully, sort of transitioned from 1P to 3P. They've obviously had some growing pains, as they've sort of hit this 2 billion mark. I think some of that is not, it's hard to sort of separate micro from macro. Obviously, the macro has gotten really bad, sort of this year and even sort of towards the end of last year. But, you know, we think we think marketplace makes a ton of sense in the Nordics. There's a lot of rational owners sitting around the table that, you know, want to, you know, maximize equity value per share. I think the restructuring and the sort of the mutual agreement to, you know, part ways with the CEO, I think shows people that, you know, that everybody sitting around the table wants to maximize equity value per share, whether that's through a sale, a merger, or hiring an exceptional entrepreneurial e-commerce CEO that can effectively grow this thing throughout a challenging environment. I think, you know, everyone is sort of open to, you know, the best, you know, scenario to maximize shareholder value. But I mean, look, absent any sort of trade, sale, merger, whatever, I think what the company did was what they were supposed to do, which is say, adapt to the new market, you know, right size the cost structure so that we can preserve the value in the near term, so we're not rushed into making a decision that isn't in the best interest for shareholders in the long term.
Great answer, Adam. So if we change the subject now, if you don't want to share anything else about CDON.
No, I think that's it. I mean, I think the short answer is, you know, we're sort of scratching our heads, you know, asking why the asset is trading here. But you know, look, you know, we invite, you know, anyone, you know, from the Nordics to reach out. You know, my email is on the internet. It's adam@awcapital. If anyone has any great ideas for us, or, you know, wants to share some opinions, we're obviously receptive in taking it. And, you know, obviously we want listeners and everyone else to understand that, you know, we are highly motivated to maximize value per share, and that the restructuring efforts is, you know, sort of a testament to that. So the company will, you know, will be profitable next year. And maybe we get lucky and Nordic e-commerce rebounds and, you know, we end up growing nicely. But, you know, I still think that the opportunity is very much intact. And I think anyone who sort of takes a longer term view and lens can look at this and say, if this company continues to win market share, which they're doing today and last year, and you think that the market in Sweden grows 10%, I mean, just do the math, right? If the market in Sweden grows 10% a year and we continue to win market share at the same clip, then this business will grow 20% a year. And if you can grow GMV 20% a year off of this base, I think you're going to make, you know, tens, twenties, hundreds of times your money. And so I think people just need to be patient and say, hey, you know, we're not going to be in a recession forever. And, you know, people will go back to shopping online. And if CDON continues to win market share, which they've done, by the way, they've won market share with no management. I mean, we didn't even have, you know, we had like an interim CEO all year last year, and we still won market share. So I think that the business model works. I think, you know, people just sort of have to look around the corner a little bit. And I think it's hard to do when the economy's bad. But I think if you look around the corner and you just sort of roll out to 23, if the market grows 5 and we grow 20, I think people are going to get really surprised at what the EBITDA and margins and everything look like.
Yeah. So tell us more about another investment of yours, Rix.
You know, Rix is sort of the opposite of CDON. It's a very sort of easy and sleepy business. We acquired it in the middle of COVID. It was, you know, very much traded, you know, trading for, oh, it's similar to CDON in some ways in that, you know, everyone sort of thought, you know, that it was, you know, not going to make it and not survive and blah, blah, blah. And they've been running it for 20 years and company was trading for less than real estate equity. And, you know, everyone said, oh, no one's ever going to go to a gentleman's club again in the middle of COVID. The same way no one's ever going to buy a basketball in CDON again, right?
So tell us, what does Rix do?
They operate bars and restaurants, you know, gentlemen's clubs. And then they also own, and they also operate restaurants with female bartenders and whatnot, and called Bombshells. And, you know, the company's been around a long time. The CEO's been running it for a very long time. And, you know, during COVID, you know, everyone was basically like, oh, no one's going to go to a bar again. No one's going to ever go to a gentleman's club again. And we said, well, that's not true. Like, COVID is very scary, but like ultimately, you know, healthy people are surviving. We saw what happened with Spanish flu. And, you know, just like CDON, right, we said, this COVID is not going to be around forever. It's not going to be 10 years. And we're going to get through it. We're going to get a vaccine. I mean, there were no vaccines for Spanish flu, right? And we got through it in a year and a half with no modern medicine, right? This was 1917. So, you know, we basically bought it and said, this thing's not going bankrupt. They own their own real estate. And in a year and a half from now, people are going to look back and be like, why, you know, why was this trading here? And that's what we did. We bought 10% of the company. And it's very similar to CDON, right? Nordic e-commerce is a disaster. No one wants to, you know, everyone's going through bad energy prices. No one's going to do this, do that. And in a year and a half, energy prices are going to come down and people are going to go back to shopping online and the recession is going to be over and you're going to be buying something from CDON because it's a marketplace and they'll have more merchants. And that was the analysis we did on Rick's, right? We basically were like, people like this. COVID is a Six Sigma event, and this company is going to continue to do what they're doing, which is to continue to, you know, buy and improve these gentlemen's clubs. Just 2 days ago, they just bought a group of clubs that's going to do 15 of EBITDA. They just grew their business by 15% in a snap of a finger. And they own their real estate. They operate these clubs. They sell food. It's just an exceptional business. And, you know, look, it, you know, obviously the company is held up. You know, it's very economically resilient. Because they own their real estate, it's an amazing inflation hedge. You know, rents don't go up. And so, you know, when they take up their prices on their alcohol and cover charge, you know, it all flows through the margin. So it's a very exciting business. We love it.
And if I'm not mistaken, there's also like this interesting capital allocation history behind the management, right? So can you just tell us more about that, you know, the buybacking of shares and so on?
Yeah, I mean, look, obviously, like anything, you know, it takes time for people to sort of figure out how to allocate capital. And, you know, look, CDON, again, you know, you got smart people around the table. So, you know, when you have a flexible cost structure, you know, if you're operating a truck and a crane company, it's very hard to sort of modify unit economics and margins. But, you know, I think the CEO of Rick's was sort of chasing revenue at all costs for a while. And I think recognized that, you know, because of his cost structure and sort of the unit economics, you know, if they could sort of focus on making sure that they, you know, grew free cash flow per share and, you know, that they, you know, looked at the returns of what they were investing in, whether it was, you know, building a Bombshells at an unlevered 30 or buying a gentleman's club at a 20, you know, an unlevered 25, you know, I think, you know, management, you know, was very, very focused on sort of growing revenues and, you know, growing the sort of the image. And I think about 10 years ago, a family office in Australia or New Zealand, you know, presented the book, The Outsiders, to the CEO. And he said, wow, this really makes sense. All I need to do is grow free cash flow per share. I need to, you know, allocate my capital. If there's good M&A to do at low multiples, we'll do that. And if there's not, we'll use our cash flow to buy back stock. And because I know that these assets are going to continue to grow. And it's just incredible how powerful capital allocation is and putting that framework in. And CDON is the same thing, right? Like, we didn't want to waste money on long-term investments. If we can run the business on a lower cost structure and make EBITDA and, you know, allocate resources to the things that are going to generate the highest return on invested capital, then that's what we should be doing. And I think sometimes it's not second nature to certain CEOs, and, you know, sometimes those CEOs need to go, and that's what happened at CDON. But, you know, in the case of, you know, RCI, the CEO was an owner operator and he had many shares, right? He has 800,000 shares. I mean, this guy's got $80 million. He's got $80 million invested in this company. So he obviously cares about maximizing equity value per share. And I'll tell you, that's actually, if you ask me, the biggest challenge with investing in Sweden is that, you know, you have guys like Daniel Ek and you have families like Hanny Moritz and you have some wonderful, you know, families that, you know, really understand capital allocation, Wallenberg and stuff like that. But, you know, many of these companies do not have owner operators. You know, they go public and, you know, they're run by corporate people that, you know, heads I win, tails I win. And, you know, I'll sort of leave it at that. You know, that's not what's happening at CDON anymore. You know, the people sitting around the table are owners, myself and Right Ventures and, you know, Mandatum and, you know, Farview, you know, we are all owners and the company is going to be run with an owner's mentality. And I think that to me has sort of been the largest challenge in Sweden, is that trying to find people that operate companies with an owner mentality. I've been able to successfully recruit some people in the United States. You know, we have a large investment in Par Technology and, you know, we brought on Savneet Singh and, you know, obviously, you know, he has a lifelong entrepreneur, but we put him into the company with an owner's, you know, sort of an owner's compensation structure where he only really makes money if the stock works and works big. And so, you know, convincing owner operators to do the right thing is a much easier sales process, right? You know, and so I think, you know, walking into RCI and, you know, delivering this message of like, your stock's going to explode if you do these things, it was an easy thing. And I think that was sort of a similar, you know, at Par Technology, you know, it was an owner operated company, but very poorly run. And, you know, we as shareholders came in there and said, look, if you hire this new guy and you cut these costs and blah, 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 like you're going to maximize your per share value. And that's, you know, we bought par at 8, it went to 90. It's, you know, obviously down with the software index and whatnot now, but it's really about aligning interests. And I think ultimately investing is finding great businesses that have flexible capital structures and flexible business models, but also making sure that the people that running them and people that are sitting around them are aligned in terms of, you know, financial motivation. And I think that to me has, I think, been largely the most challenging part of CDON, which is that, you know, the owners are very much aligned, but that we have the people that are spearheading the value creation are also economically aligned in the same capacity. And I can promise everyone listening on this call that, you know, anything that happens on CDON from here, whether it's management or strategy, is all going to be geared towards maximizing per share value.
Never, ever underestimate the power of incentives, right?
That's right. It's the most important thing.
Yeah, I agree. I actually think skin in the game might be the most important KPI for an investor.
It's certainly one that we fall close to. And, you know, again, I think, you know, we're a little bit, you know, misunderstood in the Nordics. And I think we've wanted to get on the horn with some of you guys. And, you know, Martin Hovner said all this stuff about ants. And I know people on Twitter are talking about ants. I mean, I want to set the record straight on this ant thing. It was more a conversation around retail. You know, look, you know, retail in the United States, retail Sweden, it's all the same, right? They sort of, you know, they yell smoke and there's, you know, they yell smoke in a room and think it's fire. In our mind, you know, we think, you know, the retail is very important in that they need to, you know, go and use the products and whatnot. But, you know, I think in our minds, you know, we are very, very intensely focused on maximizing per share value and maximizing customer experience. And we care deeply about the Swedish consumer because we want them to do well and we want them to shop on our stores. And I think it's important. I mean, I think it's important in Sweden. I think it's important in the United States. I think it's important everywhere. The customer has to be prioritized. We have to continue to raise the bar on the experience. I was just saying that, like, you know, much of sort of the stuff that sort of gets circulated about around these companies is retail. I mean, look, even Rick, there was a dancer who was taking a picture at a empty nightclub saying, oh, Rick's going to go down to zero because our club is empty. Well, that club was terrible and, you know, it's probably going to go bankrupt and it had nothing to do with Rick. So, you know, it's just, it's very, very important for us that, you know, that investors understand that we care deeply about this company and deeply about the consumer and we care deeply about our cost of capital. And, you know, we want to make sure that, you know, that investors don't get diluted and that their value is maximized on a per share basis because I myself am an owner. CDON will work because I own 28% of it and Wright owns 26% of it. And whether that's a sale of the company or a merger, whether it's, you know, getting a rock star CEO that is an entrepreneur that, you know, owns a bunch of stock and, you know, works 24 hours a day on it, it will work because we're going to make it work because we're restructuring the business and it's going to be break-even EBITDA. And if the economy goes down even more, we'll restructure even more. So the per share value of this opportunity will be preserved under any circumstance. And that's something that I think is underscores the fact that, you know, who controls and runs the company, it's the owners. And, you know, you need to make sure that, you know, management is aligned with you in that capacity. And I think that's what we have, you know, if you think about the underlying focus of all of our companies, whether it's Rick or Par or GFL or API Group, every single one of our companies is owner operated. Now, CDON is the only one that has not historically been owner operated. You know, it's been owner controlled, but not owner operated. And I can promise you that, you know, that to me was sort of the mistake in CDON and with Peter Kjellberg, which is, you know, he's a corporate gun and, you know, he had $100,000 into this thing and he doesn't care. You know, if you want my honest opinion, I think he wanted to become a public company CEO because no one ever would have hired him as a public company CEO. And he was a CMO, you know, he's a marketing sales guy and he saw an opportunity to become the CEO of a company and he probably couldn't have been the CEO of Thule or Dometic. And, you know, I think the next CEO of this company is going to be highly numerate, highly focused on return on invested capital. And I can promise you that he will have a copy of The Outsiders in his mailbox the minute he gets hired.
So tell us, Adam, have CDON developed in line with your estimates from when you made your investment?
Yes and no. I would say that 10-15%, you know, we would have expected more GMV growth last year, but, you know, obviously they beat the market. This year, obviously, the market is down. You know, I think they've won market share. You know, do I think that the company is executing on some level? Yes. But I think it just comes down to prioritization and cost structure. And I think the cost structure was not right for a down market. And I think the prioritization of resources was not right. You know, I didn't, I think creating a pre-owned thing and, you know, doing a lot of long dated stuff that might make sense, you know, 5 years from now, I think is not as important as, you know, food and pharma. I mean, the market was up in September. And I think that was because of food and pharma. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of wood to chop and low hanging fruit on the categories, you know, the food, pharma, and, you know, that, you know, to me, it's sort of like, yeah, CDON's always big in electronics, but if you're a marketplace, you should be able to touch all of the categories without any risk, right? Think about it. That's the part that people don't understand, which is that, like, there is no risk associated with expanding categories. You're not carrying inventory, right? The risk is that you spend money on sales and marketing, advertising, but that's a very, very low risk. And so, you know, fundamentally, do I think that the company has made some progress? Absolutely. Do I think that we've gotten blindsided a little bit with the macro? Yes. Obviously, Nordic e-commerce is down and software and technology multiples are down. Did we expect that, that both were going to hit us at the same time when we made this investment? No. Do I think that the company has made progress? Yes. Do I think that that progress will be accelerated based on a prioritization of resources? Absolutely. Do I think that the company is going to be in better shape next year because they have the right cost structure and investors can be, you know, really, you know, can understand that they're not going to be diluted and that, you know, that people sitting around them are maximizing the per share value? Yes. So, like, from a fundamental perspective, I think the situation is far better than it's ever been since we started. You know, from a share price perspective, you know, we're obviously disappointed, but, you know, the only thing we can do is make sure that we preserve the value per share. And that's the cost structure and that is the managerial, and that's the managerial focus going forward.
You've touched upon the cultural differences between Sweden and the US for a bit. It would be interesting to hear your view on ESG here in Sweden and how it differs from the US. If you look at Rick's Hospitality, for example, that would be a non-ESG investment here in Sweden, and we are pretty strict with it normally. How does Americans value an investment like Rick's Hospitality when it comes to ESG?
Well, it's hard for sure. I mean, look, obviously, you know, there are a lot of people that look at it and say it's not ESG. Now, in fact, we think it is ESG because, you know, obviously, these are predominantly clubs with women, and, you know, obviously, they can make a lot of money. And, you know, there are many of women there that, you know, put their kids through college, send themselves through college. In fact, there was a book written, it's on Amazon, about a woman who put herself through Brown University dancing at a local club. So, you know, look, obviously there's, you know, lots of people think that, you know, sex trafficking originates at gentlemen's clubs. I think less than 1% of sex trafficking originates at a gentleman's club, you know, probably originates more at a bar than anywhere else. You know, it's like, you know, so in my head, it's sort of like, I think that, you know, there's a lot of arguments for why it is ESG in terms of, you know, female empowerment and what have you. So, you know, I don't, you know, necessarily worry about it. There are clearly people that it's not within their mandate, but, you know, look, obviously the company has tried to sort of communicate their message that it is ESG and it is, you know, female empowerment. But, you know, I think that that's been less of a concern for us with this investment only because there's so much passive capital, right? There's so many, there's the Renaissance Technologies, there's the AQRs, there's Dimensionals. And so, you know, because the financial algorithm is so powerful, you know, we actually don't even think that any human beings need to buy Rick, right? We don't. We think that, you know, if the company continues to execute on their sort of EVA, right? You know, call it their capital allocation process or their, you know, economic value add, right? If they buy clubs at 4x EBITDA and they sell at 10x EBITDA and they do it in some component of cash and stock and note, you know, that EVA, right? Because that's economic value add, right? You buy a club at 4x, you sell for 10x, you give them a little bit of stock, you give them a little bit of debt, and you generate cash. Like, you have to believe that, you know, that the multiple is going to, you know, trade below 4x EBITDA, but it won't because these businesses grow with inflation and real estate and this and that. And so, you know, to us, it's sort of like, we don't like it here when everyone says it's not ESG, but like, it's like, okay, great. Like, I know that there are certain people that can't own it because they can't tell their boss. Great. But like, does that mean that a computer can't buy it based on an economic value add screen? And sort of in our mind, it's sort of like, if you can continue to grow EBITDA and grow free cash flow per share, you know, you don't need a human being to buy it. 75% of the capital is moving passively anyways. When Rick's goes over $1 billion market cap, we think that 7% of the company is going to have to get acquired by index funds. Where's the stock going to go? 150? I'm not selling it.
Interesting take. I also just have to ask you, Adam, you know, you touched upon this before, you know, the retail ants story. Can you just tell us what happened here? Because that was like a story that really took fire, you know, in the financial Twitter community here in Sweden. So tell us here, what happened?
I think what happened is someone was making fun of me on Twitter or something, and they had a picture of an ant or something. And then Martin Hovner, you know, said something to me. He was asking me, and I said, oh, the retail guys, they're just like ants. I mean, it was sort of taken completely out of context, right? It's sort of like, you know, look, and it's not even Sweden specifically. I mean, in the United States, you know, people are tweeting about, you know, DraftKings and all these Carvana. I mean, there's lots of retail people that, you know, sort of, as I said before, it's sort of, you know, you like to yell fire in a crowded movie theater and sort of elicit a response. But, you know, look, obviously, all of the institutional owners are very much aligned. If you look at the cap tables, you know, none of the institutional owners have changed their ownership. Not me, not Wright, not Mandatum, not Farview, not whatever. If anything, everyone's increased. So, you know, look, I mean, one of the frustrating parts of CDON is that it's so closely held. If one guy sometimes one guy sells, you know, is that really instructive of sort of the value prop? So, you know, our hope is that, you know, at these types of valuations, you know, whoever is sort of interested in sort of selling 100,000 shares, that eventually abates, and you know, so, you know, new people are able to sort of see that the opportunity is, you know, immensely dislocated relative to sort of the strategic value and sort of, you know, DCF value of the company. But, you know, look, the ant thing was not meant in a pejorative way. It was just, you know, some guy poking me in the eye, and I just made a comment. I said, oh, you know, these retail guys, they're just like ants. They, you know, they want to yell smoke in a crowded movie theater. But to be perfectly honest, it has nothing to do with, my feelings towards Swedish investors or Swedish people. I love going to Sweden. I think the food's great. I think it's got a lot of enviable characteristics. You know, if some guy who is sitting in his boxer shorts, you know, on an interactive brokers terminal shorting 400 shares, you know, likes to tweet at me and say, oh, blah, 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 like, there's nothing I can do about that. But I have a deep appreciation for the economy and the culture and this business. And, you know, we are very, very focused on, you know, making it a world-beating marketplace. So those retail guys that are making fun of me can buy great products on the internet, and they can and have a great consumer experience.
Sounds like a beautiful ending. So I think that was all from us. And we want to give a big thank you to you, Adam, for taking the time and giving us lots of insights today.
All right, very good. Thanks, Adam. Thank you for the time.
Thank you. And to all the listeners, we'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening.
And before we end, we would like to remind you that all the Swedish listed companies, including CDON, are available on Pinpoint. Don't forget to submit your own estimates to see the estimates for CDON, for example.
You will find the link to Pinpoint in the description. A big thanks to our main sponsor, Pinpoint Estimates.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.